From twisted motives to unimaginable violence, this video about the world's most evil children uncovers the horrific crimes committed by children capable of unspeakable acts. Brace yourself for a spine-tingling journey as we delve into the disturbing stories of 15 young perpetrators, examining the depths of their depravity and how their actions make you question the very nature of evil. Jasmine Richardson. In the quiet town of Medicine Hut, Alberta, Canada, a horrific and shocking crime took place that would forever haunt the community. It was April 23, 2006, when the lives of the Richardson family were brutally cut short in their own home. Mark Richardson, a 42-year-old father, Deborah Richardson, a 48-year-old mother, and their 8-year-old son, Tyler Jacob, were victims of a horrific act of violence that shocked the entire country. The scene was one of unimaginable horror, as the couple had been brutally stabbed to death in their basement and their infant son found dead upstairs. The absence of their 12-year-old daughter, Jasmine Richardson, added to the confusion and fear. For a brief moment, there was a glimmer of hope that she had escaped the violence. However, that hope was dashed when it emerged that Jasmine was not a victim, but the perpetrator of the heinous crime. Jasmine Richardson was not arrested until the following day, but not at Medicine Hut. She was found in the Saskatchewan community of Leader, about 130 kilometers from her hometown, and she was not alone. With her was her 23-year-old boyfriend, Jeremy Allen Steinke, who would later adopt the name Jackson May. As the investigation unfolded, the motive behind the Richardson family murders became clear. Jasmine's parents had punished her for her relationship with Steinke, citing the significant age difference as a cause for concern. The couple also had an unsettling relationship with Steinke, who claimed to be a 300-year-old werewolf and even wore a vial of his blood around his neck, a macabre symbol of his obsession. In the days leading up to the murders, the couple's behavior became increasingly disturbing. They would watch the film Natural Born Killers, a violent film about a young couple who go on a killing spree. On July 9, 2007, Richardson, who by then had turned 13, was found guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder, making her the youngest person ever convicted of multiple counts of first-degree murder in Canada. Despite her age, Richardson was sentenced to the maximum sentence allowed by law for someone her age, 10 years in prison. In November 2008, Steinke was tried and convicted by a jury of 3 counts of first-degree murder for the murders of Richardson's 3 victims. On December 15, 2008, Stein was sentenced to 3 life sentences, 1 for each count of first-degree murder. The sentences were to be served concurrently, meaning he would be eligible for parole after serving 25 years. Lionel Tate. Born on January 30, 1987, in Broward County, Florida, Lionel Tate holds the infamous distinction of being the youngest U.S. citizen ever sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. It was a seemingly ordinary day on July 28, 1999, in Broward County, Florida. Lionel Tate, a 13-year-old boy, was left alone with Tiffany Uni, who was being babysat by his mother, Kathleen Grosset Tate. Little did he know that the day would mark the beginning of a nightmare. As the children played downstairs, Tate's mother yelled at them to keep quiet. Unbeknownst to her, a sinister plan was already in motion. Approximately 45 minutes later, Tate told her mother the horrific news that Tiffany was no longer breathing. What awaited Kathleen upstairs was an image that would haunt her for the rest of her days. Tiffany's tiny body was covered in bruises, and her legs, feet, and neck bore the marks of a brutal assault. The force used against her was so intense that it was comparable to being hit by a speeding car. But the physical injuries were just the beginning of the horrors Tiffany had endured. In addition to the bruises, Tiffany suffered a fractured skull, a lacerated liver, broken ribs, and swelling of her brain. Tate claimed that he was merely teaching her some wrestling moves in what was supposedly a child's game. However, her injuries were described as similar to those she would have suffered in a fall from a 3-story building. Tate was immediately arrested and, despite being just a child, was tried as an adult. Under Florida statutes, Tate was convicted of first-degree murder, even without evidence of intent to kill or injure. All that was required was the knowledge that Tate knowingly molested another child who died as a result. Prosecuting Lionel Tate in the state of Florida, in the juvenile court system, meant that Lionel faced 6 to 9 months in juvenile detention. That was 1 month for every year of this child's life. And in my opinion, that was not an appropriate sentence. It was not justice for this child. This controversial rule allowed Tate to be sentenced to life in prison without the prosecution having to prove intent or even awareness of the consequences. Amargeet Sada. In the dark annals of crime, some stories defy comprehension and shake us to the core. One such story is that of Amargeet Sada, the world's youngest serial killer. Born in the village of Musha in Bihar, India, Amargeet's name is synonymous with unimaginable evil. From an early age, Amargeet exhibited a solitary nature and often preferred to spend his time alone. It was during a visit from Amargeet's aunt, who had recently found a job in the city, that the first hints of Amargeet's sinister nature emerged. His aunt, unable to care for her own child while she adjusted to her new job, asked Amargeet's family to look after the baby. Since his mother had to go to the local market, Amargeet was left in charge of his cousin and little sister. It was then that Amargeet's true nature began to reveal itself. He began by pinching and slapping the baby, enjoying his cries, but as the baby's cries increased, so did Amargeet's actions. For unknown reasons, he decided to up the ante and put his hands around the baby's throat, depriving him of breathing until he did. When Amargeet's parents later discovered what he had done, they decided to keep the incident a secret rather than involve the authorities. Tragically, this would not be the end of Amargeet's dark journey. His next victim would be his own 8-month-old sister. While his parents slept, Amargeet strangled his innocent sister, ending her life without remorse. It wasn't until 2007 that Amargeet's crimes finally came to light. His final victim was a 6-month-old baby girl named Kushba. The baby's mother, a neighbor, had left her daughter sleeping at a local primary school. When she returned, she found every mother's worst nightmare. Her baby was missing. However, under mounting pressure and scrutiny, Amargeet's parents eventually allowed their son to confess the unimaginable. Amargeet admitted to strangling Kushba, beating her with a brick, and burying her in a shallow grave. Amazingly, he was able to lead police to the exact spot where he had hidden her lifeless body. The truth of Amargeet's crimes finally came to light, shocking the community and the entire country. Instead of facing a traditional trial, Amargeet was placed in a pre-trial detention center where he would receive the necessary care and treatment until he turned 18. He was found to have conduct disorder, a psychiatric disorder characterized by a persistent pattern of violating the rights of others and disregarding social norms. In 2016, upon his 18th birthday, Amargeet was released from prison. The decision to release him was met with mixed reactions from the public. Some believed that he had served his sentence and should be given a chance at redemption, while others feared that he continued to pose a threat to society. Amargeet Sada remains at large. It is believed that he was given a new identity to protect him from harm and to allow him to start anew. However, many question whether someone with such a dark past can ever be rehabilitated. Mary Bell. In 1968, at the tender age of 10, Mary Bell committed a series of unimaginable crimes that would forever brand her as the world's most evil child. She strangled her victims with a cold and calculating demeanor and left behind haunting confession notes that shocked her community. The details of her crimes are so gruesome that they defy belief. Born on May 26, 1957, in Newcastle, England, Mary Bell's early years were marked by neglect, abuse, and a profound lack of love and stability. As she grew older, her life took a dark turn. She became increasingly withdrawn, manipulative, and prone to violent outbursts. It is believed that her troubled upbringing, marked by neglect and abuse, played a significant role in shaping her disturbed psyche. As Mary Bell entered her preteens, her growing obsession with death became increasingly apparent. On May 25, 1968, the day before her 11th birthday, Mary Bell committed her first murder. She lured 4-year-old Martin Brown to an abandoned house in Scotswood, England, where she strangled him to death. Mary left the premises and returned with her friend Norma Bell, no relation, only to find that two local children had stumbled upon the body. Police were called and an investigation into Martin's death began. At first, Martin's death puzzled police. Aside from a small amount of blood and saliva on his face, there were no apparent signs of foul play. An empty bottle of painkillers near the body led them to believe Martin's death was an accident, the result of an overdose. Shortly after this disturbing encounter, Mary and Norma broke into a daycare center and vandalized it with notes claiming responsibility for Martin Brown's death. On July 31, 1968, Mary Bell and her friend Norma embarked on their most gruesome act yet. They lured 3-year-old Brian out to a secluded area where Mary proceeded to strangle him to death. But the horror didn't end there. In a display of unimaginable cruelty, Mary mutilated Brian's body with scissors, scratching his thighs and dismembering his genitals, leaving behind a scene of unspeakable horror. The coroner's report also revealed a disturbing detail. As Brian's blood cooled, new marks appeared on his chest. Someone had used a razor blade to scratch the letter M into his torso. A chilling signature left by Mary Bell. Norma, perhaps overcome with guilt, began cooperating with the police and implicated Mary in the crimes. She was ultimately sentenced to prison, at Her Majesty's pleasure, a British legal term denoting an indeterminate sentence. Today, Mary Bell remains under the protection of the British government and lives in anonymity under a new identity, Christian Fernandez. Christian Fernandez was just 12 years old when he killed his 2-year-old stepbrother. The toddler reportedly died from head injuries when Fernandez slammed him into a bookcase in their flat. The story begins with a seemingly ordinary family living in a modest house on Alden Road. David Galarraga, a sweet and innocent boy, was the apple of his mother's eye, but behind closed doors a sinister secret was brewing. In January 2011, David mysteriously broke his leg. His mother, Vianella Susanna, claimed it had been an accident at the gym. However, this would be the first sign of the darkness that was about to consume their lives. Then, on that fateful day in March, everything changed. Vianella made a frantic call to the police, claiming that David had fallen in their home, but the truth was far more sinister. When authorities arrived at the hospital, they were met with an image that would haunt them forever. David lay motionless, his tiny body battered and broken. His skull was fractured, his brain was bleeding, and his eyes and nose were black. Medical experts later estimated that he had been struck in the head and face more than a dozen times. The level of brutality was unfathomable. As the investigation unfolded, the grisly truth about his older half-brother, Christian Fernandez, began to emerge. While the story of exactly what happened is unclear, Christian admitted that he had become violent with the boy and had roughly shoved him into a bookcase. In fact, Christian had been the one who broke the boy's leg a few months prior to the gruesome murder. Interviewer, so he was sitting like this and then, how did you make his little legs? So that we understand what happened. Fernandez like this, interviewer, did you hear a pop? Fernandez, well, something like that. Most disturbing, however, was the fact that Bianca waited over 4 hours after arriving home before seeking medical attention for her son. At just 12 years old, Christian was charged as an adult with first-degree murder and aggravated child abuse. After months of legal battles and public outcry, a plea agreement was reached. Fernandez, now 14, appeared before Circuit Judge Mallor Cooper and pleaded guilty to murder and aggravated assault. The conviction made him the youngest person ever charged as an adult in Jacksonville history. This meant he would serve approximately 7 years on the murder charge. Kyle Wood, a 9-year-old boy charged with murder and aggravated assault, appeared in an Illinois courtroom on Monday. Kyle Wood is charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder and multiple counts of arson. Here's a chilling twist surrounding a young boy named Kyle Wood, who at the tender age of 9 committed an act so heinous that it earned him the title of the wickedest kid in the world. On the night of April 6, 2019, a quiet neighborhood in Goodfield, Illinois, was about to become the scene of a horrific tragedy. Around 11 p.m., a fire broke out in the central Peoria area near the town of Goodfield. Flames quickly engulfed a mobile home, turning it into a blazing inferno. Within minutes, firefighters were on the scene, sirens wailing through the night. As they battled the raging flames, they were unaware of the devastating loss that awaited them inside the charred structure. When the fire was finally extinguished, the stark reality dawned. Five lives had been tragically cut short. Their futures had been snuffed out in an instant. The victims of this horrific incident were three young children, all under the age of 3 to 69-year-old Catherine Murray, a grandmother, and 34-year-old Jason Wall. News of this devastating loss sent shockwaves through the community. Neighbors, friends, and family members were left in shock, struggling to comprehend the magnitude of the tragedy that had unfolded before their eyes. Amidst the chaos and grief, two people managed to survive the blaze. Katrina Alwood, 27, and her son Kyle, the alleged perpetrator of the heinous act, escaped the flames that consumed their home. 6 months after the devastating fire, the unimaginable truth came to light. Kyle Alwood, the young man who had managed to escape the flames, was arrested and charged with a series of felonies. The weight of the charges against him was staggering. Kyle, just 9 years old, faced 5 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of arson, and 1 count of aggravated arson. The severity of the charges shocked the community and the entire country. As the case progressed, the local prosecutor defended his decision to file murder charges against Kyle. He maintained that justice had to be done, but also acknowledged that due to the boy's young age, he was only expected to be released on parole if convicted. Robert Thompson and John Van Lees. In 1993, the murder of 2-year-old James Bulger shocked the nation and ignited a national debate about the age of criminal responsibility. It all began one fateful day in February. A bloodthirsty Robert Thompson and John Venables set out to commit an act of unspeakable evil. Instead of going to school as usual, they arrived at the Strand Shopping Center, their eyes scanning the crowd for a potential victim. Their sinister plan was to find a young boy to kill. As midday approached, the two boys spotted their innocent target, James Bulger. His mother was at the butcher's counter, unaware of the horror that was about to unfold. With calculated precision, Thompson and Venables lured young James away from his mother, taking advantage of a momentary distraction. Within minutes, they were out of the shopping mall, holding James by the hand, leading him towards a fate too gruesome to comprehend. Venables. So we approached him and we were walking with him and I took his hand. Detective. And whose idea was it to walk towards him? Venables. Mine, detective. It was. Venables. So it was Robert's idea to kill him. Their journey took them along canals and through alleyways, as they meticulously avoided detection. The terrified and exhausted 2-year-old had no idea of the horrors that awaited him. Finally, they came to a desolate railway track. It was there that Thompson and Venables unleashed their sadistic rage on their helpless victim. They threw rocks and bricks at James, inflicting physical pain, but their cruelty did not stop there. There they beat him with an iron bar, leaving him battered and broken. In a sickening display of depravity, they had sex with the helpless child. Venables. And we went out into the canal. Detective. What for? Venables. I don't know. We said, let's throw him in the water. He was coaxing him. He said, get on your knees, let's look at the water and all that. Quote. But he wouldn't, because when we didn't put him down, Robert picked him up and threw him on the ground. And that's where he got the bump on his head. Their evil deeds done, Thompson and Venables abandoned James on the tracks, where he was later tragically struck by a train. The severity of their actions on the railway line was grotesque and demonstrated their complete lack of empathy or remorse. The details of James' murder were so gruesome that they were not publicly revealed at the time, but the truth of their unparalleled evil would eventually come to light. The trial of Robert Thompson and John Venables captivated the nation, with the boys, just 10 years old at the time of the crime, facing angry crowds and a justice system grappling with the unprecedented nature of their actions. Despite the gravity of their actions, the court ruled that rehabilitation through institutionalization was the most sensible sentence for young offenders. Both Thompson and Venables were found guilty of murder, making them the youngest convicted murderers in modern British history. Nicholas Kedrovs. To understand the chilling crimes committed by Nicholas Kedrovics, we must first delve into his early life and the factors that may have contributed to his descent into darkness. From the outside, his childhood seemed relatively normal, with loving parents and a supportive community. However, beneath the surface lay signs of a troubled soul. Growing up, Nicholas displayed a disturbing fascination with death and the macabre. While other children played with toys and amused themselves with innocent games, Nicholas often read books about serial killers and gruesome crimes. His parents, unaware of the darkness that lurked around their son, dismissed him as a morbid curiosity. As Nicholas entered adolescence, his behavior took a sinister turn. He became withdrawn and isolated, spending hours locked in his room. His parents, concerned for his well-being, tried to understand what was happening to their son, but Nicholas remained silent, his thoughts and emotions hidden behind a mask of indifference. It was then that Nicholas began to show signs of aggression and violence. Small animals began to disappear from the neighborhood and their remains were discovered in the woods surrounding the town. Rumors began to circulate, whispers of a disturbed child with a penchant for cruelty. Despite these warning signs, no one could have predicted the depths of evil to which Nicholas would eventually sink. The true horror would come to light when his own family became victims of his twisted desires. In 2017, when he was just 13 years old, the darkness within him manifested itself in the most horrifying way imaginable. Nicholas' two-year-old half-sister, Sir McCartney, was found dead in her crib. The cause of death was ruled as suffocation. The community was devastated by the loss of such a young and innocent life. But few knew that this was only the beginning. Less than 3 months later, another unimaginable tragedy struck. This time it was Nicholas' 11-month-old half-brother, Nathaniel Rich, who fell victim to his sinister intentions. Once again, asphyxiation was the cause of death. Authorities launched a thorough investigation into the deaths of Desig and Nathaniel, and all eyes turned to Nicholas as the prime suspect. The evidence against him was overwhelming, and he ultimately confessed to the crimes. During questioning, Nicholas chillingly revealed that he believed he was freeing his brothers from hell. He claimed to have been tormented by visions and voices urging him to carry out these acts of violence. The depths of his delusions were truly disturbing and left investigators and psychologists baffled. The trial that followed was a harrowing ordeal for all involved. After careful deliberation, the jury returned their verdict, guilty. Nicholas Kedrovic was sentenced to 2 consecutive 50-year terms, ensuring he would spend the rest of his life behind bars. The community breathed a sigh of relief, knowing that this dangerous individual would never walk among them again. Michelle Johnson and Andrew Golden. Dispatch 911, what is your emergency? Call. People have been shot at Westside Middle School. Dispatch, what? Call. Shots fired at Westside Middle School. Dispatch, okay, call. We need an ambulance ASAP. On March 24, 1998, 13-year-old Michelle Johnson and 11-year-old Andrew Golden went on a horrific rampage at Westside Middle School in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Armed with multiple weapons, they took the lives of 4 students and a teacher, leaving a community shattered and a nation in disbelief. It was a day that would forever be etched in the memory of the small community of Jonesboro, Arkansas. Westside Middle School became the backdrop for a horrific act of violence that would shock the nation. The perpetrators were 13-year-old Mitchell Johnson and 11-year-old Andrew Golden. Together, they would commit one of the most heinous crimes in American history. The night before the shooting, Michelle Johnson enlisted the help of his accomplice, Andrew Golden, to load his mother's Dodge Caravan with camping gear, snacks, and a chilling arsenal of stolen weapons. Among the stolen firearms were a Remington 742,306 rifle, a Universal 30M1 carbine replica, a Ruger 44 Magnum rifle, a Smith & Wesson 38 special revolver, a 2-gauge double-bore Derringer, a CEP-38180 pistol, a Star Punch 380 pistol, a Ruger Security 6357 revolver, a Davis Industries 38 two-shot Derringer, and a Charter Arms 38 special revolver. They also carried 2,000 rounds of ammunition to ensure they had more than enough firepower for their sinister plan. The next morning, as the sun rose at Westside Middle School, Johnson and Golden arrived late and deliberately missed the bus. Little did their classmates and teachers know that their tardiness was part of a meticulously calculated plan. As the school day began, Golden pulled the fire alarm shortly after 12:30 p.m. during the beginning of fifth period. The blare of sirens and the flashing of lights threw the school into a state of confusion and panic as chaos ensued. Johnson took the stolen weapons into the woods outside the school. It was there that he and Golden had planned to carry out their sinister act of violence. As students and teachers evacuated the building, the two boys emerged from the woods, their faces masked with chilling determination. Weapons in hand, they opened fire on their unsuspecting classmates and teachers. The shooting lasted only a few minutes, but the impact would be felt for a lifetime. Johnson and Golden attempted to flee the scene, but their plan was thwarted by the swift response of law enforcement. Just 10 minutes after the shooting began, they were apprehended by police. The lives of four innocent students and one dedicated teacher had been tragically cut short, leaving a void that could never be filled. The trial of Johnson and Golden was a somber affair as the community grappled with the unthinkable acts committed by two young men. After careful deliberation, the jury found Johnson and Golden guilty on all counts. Due to their age, Johnson and Golden were sentenced to confinement until they turned 21. They were transferred to the Arcadia Juvenile Assessment and Treatment Center, the most secure juvenile facility in the state. After serving 7 years and 4 months in prison, Johnson was released on his 21st birthday. Golden was also released on his 21st birthday after serving 9 years and 2 months in prison. In another legal battle, the victims' families filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Johnson and Golden. The court awarded them $150 million in damages, a symbolic victory intended to prevent either man from profiting from their heinous act. Sadly, Golden's story came to a tragic end on July 27, 2019, when he was involved in a fatal car accident. The collision claimed his life along with that of another driver. It was a somber reminder of the lasting impact of the Westside High School shooting. Family murdered. Mason Sisk and their 14-year-old son allegedly confessed to crime. The 14-year-old faces 5 counts of juvenile murder in the shooting deaths of his father and stepmother, John and Mary Sisk, ages 38 and 35. His 6-month-old brother, his 4-year-old sister, and his 6-year-old brother. At the tender age of 14, Mason Sisk executed 5 members of his own family, including an infant and 2 young children, in an act of cold-blooded violence. Mason was born into a seemingly normal family in Elkmont, Alabama. His parents, John and Mary Sisk, appeared to be a loving couple, devoted to their children and their community. Beneath the surface, however, lurked tensions and conflicts in the Sisk household. According to neighbors and friends, the family had a history of arguments and disagreements. Mason's parents would frequently engage in heated arguments that would sometimes escalate into physical altercations. The children, including Mason, witnessed these disturbing scenes, which undoubtedly had a profound impact on their young minds. As the eldest, Mason should have been a role model and protector for his younger siblings. However, the family dynamic was far from harmonious. Mason's anger management issues were evident from a young age, and he would often clash with his parents and siblings. Tension within the Sisk household reached a breaking point in the months leading up to the tragic events of September 2, 2019. Mason's anger and frustration had been growing, fueled by the constant arguing and the strain of his parents' troubled relationship. Armed with a handgun, he methodically shot each member of the family in the head, ending their lives in a matter of minutes. The brutality and cold-bloodedness of his actions were beyond comprehension. The loss of 5 lives, including those of innocent children, left friends, neighbors, and family devastated and searching for answers. At first, Mason attempted to mislead investigators, claiming that he had been in the basement playing video games at the time of the murders. He made up claims that he had heard gunshots and seen a vehicle leaving the scene. However, as evidence against him mounted, Mason's facade crumbled and he eventually confessed to the heinous crime. Mason's motive for his actions gradually became clear as the investigation progressed. He admitted that he had grown tired of the constant arguments within his family. The toxic environment, coupled with the difficulties the children were going through, pushed him to a breaking point. While it is difficult to comprehend how a 14-year-old could commit such a horrific act, the motive provides a glimpse into the deep-seated anger and resentment that consumed Mason's young mind. The following April, Mason Sisk stood trial for his heinous crimes. The prosecution vociferously demanded the harshest punishment possible given the nature of the crime. Mason Sisk, now 18, stood trial before the judge and his fate was sealed. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The chilling motive for these murders serves as a stark reminder of the depths of human depravity, challenging our understanding of what drives people to commit such heinous acts and forcing us to confront the terrifying potential that lies within even the youngest members of society. For more riveting videos like this one, click on the cards that appear on your screen and I'll be waiting for you.